Oh, my God, she stammered. We killed his son. And now that psychotic bastard is coming for me. Just like he promised he would. She swung toward her stunned national security advisor. That's what this is all about, Dr. Rauch. Revenge. Pure and simple. McClanahan wants me dead. And after his goons missed me at Barksdale, he's going for the next best thing. Wrecking my re-election campaign. She felt cold dread ripple down her spine. Christ. Once I'm out of office, I'll be a sitting duck. No matter how many Secret Service agents I have protecting me, those goddamn CIDs of his will cut right through them and rip my heart out. But General McClanahan's son is not dead, Caldwell interjected. Intelligence reports from a number of sources confirm that he's on active service with the Iron Wolf Squadron. Angrily, Barbeau waved the reminder aside. It doesn't matter. The McClanahan kid is a total non-entity, she said forcefully. His father's the real threat. He's always been able to round up rabid followers to execute his insane plans, she shuddered. Now we know what's going on. Martindale and the Poles must have lost their control over him. He's gone completely rogue. Rauch swallowed hard.
That's possible, he admitted. In fact, there is one more piece of data that may lend credibility to your hypothesis.
Go on, she rapped through gritted teeth.
The two F-35 pilots who carried out your orders over Poland were present at Barksdale Air Force Base when it was attacked, he said slowly.
So?
They were both killed, Rauch said.
She stared back at him, feeling suddenly nauseous. Get out, she snarled. She jerked her head toward the door, including Admiral Caldwell and his aide in the gesture. All of you, get out now.
For a long, terrible moment after they left, Stacy Ann Barbeau sat in silence, staring into nothingness with a worn and haggard face.
Outside AT&T Cowboys Stadium, Arlington, Texas. That same time. With the monumental glass, steel, concrete, and fabric structure of Cowboys Stadium rising nearly 300 feet in the air behind him, John Dalton Farrell strode confidently down the walk toward the spot where his campaign staff had set up microphones and a podium. Reporters jostled each other in front of the podium, angling for the best shot at gaining his recognition during what was described as a brief press availability. Through the massive stadium's open retractable roof, he could hear the muffled rattle of drums and the keening sound of bagpipes as the last honor guards and bands marched slowly away. Apart from the normal sounds of traffic, an almost unearthly hush had fallen across the area. It was almost as if every one of the 100,000 people who had attended this public memorial service were holding their breath in a spontaneous moment of silence for the National Guard troops, law enforcement officers, and F-35 assembly plant workers who'd been killed at Fort Worth. Farrell stepped up to the microphones and nodded gravely to the assembled members of the media.
I won't be making a prepared statement this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, he told them quietly.
He nodded back toward the stadium.
The memory of the brave men and women we've honored here today deserves more than canned political double talk.
The crow's feet around his eyes deepened as he shot them a quick, self-mocking smile.
Which means I'll have to do my best to just give you straight answers to your questions.
That opened the floodgates. Over the braying din of dozens of journalists all trying to talk over each other, he picked out one, Lindy Vance. His staff had privately dubbed the blonde-haired CNN reporter the Inquisitor. They called her that because she always seemed more interested in accusing Farrell of some heinous personal fault or failing than in seeking genuine insight into what he proposed to do as president.
Go ahead, Lindy, he said into the mic, pointing at her.
Behind the crowd of reporters, Farrell saw Sarah Patel and Mike Dowell cringe. He hid a grin.
They could never understand why he so often gave this particular reporter the first crack at him. He'd tried explaining that it was precisely because her questions were so obviously biased that it worked in his favor, especially with undecided voters. But they couldn't seem to wrap their heads around the concept. In his view, most people had enough common sense to pick up on someone playing gotcha games instead of asking fair questions. True to form, Lindy Vance didn't disappoint him.
"What was the real point of this big public show of yours, Governor?" she said with cool cynicism, dripping from every syllable. "Was it part of a deliberate political strategy to make President Barbeau look bad?"
"Not at all, Miss Vance," Farrell replied calmly. "Yes, the president was invited to be here today, but I think every decent American understands that she has more than enough on her plate in dealing with this crisis. She is our commander-in-chief, and given the security risks, it would have been foolish for her to further expose herself to a possible terrorist attack."
While every word of what he said was literally true, he could almost hear his long-departed mother's voice telling him, "You are going to hell for that fib, John D." No matter how you sliced it, and intentionally or not, his public appearances contrasted sharply with Stacy Ann Barbeau's continuing refusal to leave the heavily guarded confines of Wright-Patterson. Her terse, tough-sounding televised speeches full of vague promises to destroy those attacking our beloved country were no substitute for a demonstrated willingness to share some of the risks run by others.
"You're seriously claiming you won't criticize President Barbeau for not showing up at this memorial service?"
another journalist chimed in with open disbelief.
"That's not a claim. That's a cold hard fact," Farrell shot back. "I will never criticize the president for acting sensibly."
He showed his teeth in a slashing half smile. "Especially since she does it so rarely." Then he shrugged.
"I will, however, gladly dispute some of those anonymous administration sources y'all are so fond of quoting."
"About what?" a third reporter asked.
"Poland is not our enemy," he said bluntly. "Nor are the brave men and women volunteers in the Iron Wolf Squadron who are risking their lives to help the Poles and their allies stay free and independent. And whoever is out there telling you anything different is full of bullcrap."
Lindy Vance raised a skeptical eyebrow.
"Then just who is responsible for these terrorist attacks?" she asked. "Metal men from Mars?"
"Since the president refuses to provide me with access to national security intelligence, all I can do is speculate, Lindy," Farrell said. "But if I were a betting man, and I am a betting man, my money would be on Russia. And on its cruel, vengeful, and often reckless leader, Gennady Gryzlov."
That drew pained stares from many of the press. Most of them had long since stopped writing glowing stories about Russia's charismatic young president. But that didn't mean they liked hearing what they considered to be worn-out, old-fashioned Cold War-style boilerplate served up this way. One of them sneered openly.
"Oh, come on, Governor, you're clutching at straws. Every military expert we talk to comes back to one basic fact. The Poles and the mercenaries they pay are the only ones in the world with the kind of war robots that have been attacking us. Last time I looked, there were a whole lot of experts around who've turned out to be dead wrong about a whole lot of things,"
Farrell said dryly.
"For example, I earned a couple of $1 billion pumping oil and gas the experts said didn't exist."
As he'd expected, that little sally drew some laughs, albeit reluctant ones.
"Weapons aren't magic talismans," he went on more seriously. "They're devices made by men, pure and simple. And what one man can make, another man can copy. Or steal."
In the short silence that followed, Farrell saw Sarah Patel tap her watch significantly. He nodded slightly and turned back to the reporters.
"Now, folks, you're going to have to excuse me, but I need to wrap this up."
Undeterred, Lindy Vance got in one more shot. Is the line your staff has been feeding us about your plans for the next couple of weeks accurate, or just spin?
What line is that? Farrell asked.
That you're going to take some time off the campaign trail. That you're retreating to that Texas Hill Country ranch of yours for the next few days.
Farrell nodded. It is, Lindy. He shrugged. Partly it's to avoid further politicizing events in this time of crisis. As you've noticed, it might be unfair of me to continue campaigning while the president is locked away, unable to respond in kind. But mostly, I want some quiet time to put serious meat and bone on the reform proposals I'm taking to the American people in November. He shrugged. My office in Austin will keep you apprised of any important developments, but I don't expect there'll be much to report before the convention. Now, after that, you best buckle up tight, because I plan to hit the campaign trail running hard. There's no prize for second place when it comes to the White House, and I am in this race to win.
30. Over Southern California. That same time. Reagan Air Flight 281 cruised south-southwest through the night sky over Southern California. Flying from its base near Moab, Utah, it approached the border near Mexicali, Mexico.
Reagan Air 281, radar services terminated. Contact Tijuana TCA on 119.5. Good evening.
The Southern California Terminal radar controller radioed.
119.5, Reagan 281, Roger, good evening.
The pilot aboard Reagan Air 281 responded. The controller checked the flight information strip. The flight was dead on time and course, as reported to U.S. Customs Border Protection. He picked up his telephone and hit a button for a direct connection line.
CBP Lewis,
came the reply a moment later, all for the benefit of the digital memory system recording every word.
Simpson at SoCal, the controller replied. Reagan 281 is right on time and course, as filed.
Copy, thanks.
And the line went dead. Both operators were off the hook now. Reagan Air 281 had flown exactly where and when they said it was going to do. And now it was Mexico's target. Big, privately chartered cargo jets flying into Mexico at night always raised suspicion. But Reagan Air had filed all the proper paperwork with both the U.S. and Mexican authorities and had been exactly where and when they said they'd be. And they were flying away from the United States. So it was someone else's concern now. It was again suspicious that the flight didn't land at the first port of entry airport at General Rodriguez International in Tijuana. Flights inbound to the U.S. were required to land at the first port of entry after crossing the border and were not permitted to fly past any port of entry. But Mexico was different. And again, it was not CBP's or SoCal's problem any longer. Reagan Air 281 proceeded south on San Felipe, and its small, non-towered regional airport for its customs inspection. The small detachment of federales and comandante had already been paid off, so when they boarded the plane, they relaxed in the 737's six-seat passenger section forward of the walled-off cargo section, enjoyed a cigar and some cerveza, waited the proper amount of time that it might take for an inspection, then departed. After refueling, the plane took off and headed back west-northwest, and then entered a timing orbit 90 kilometers from San Felipe, on the other side of the 10,000-foot-high Picacho del Diablo, Devil's Peak. Inside the cockpit, Colonel Yuri Anyenkov and Major Konstantin Uspensky were busy working their way through their attack checklist.
All four rotary launchers are online, Uspensky said from the co-pilot seat. They are linked to our attack computer.
Anyenkov nodded.
Activate the KH-35 satellite navigation systems.
While waiting for his co-pilot to finish this step, he took a quick look outside. Off to their left, the whole horizon glowed. From this altitude, even more than 250 kilometers away, the lights of Los Angeles, San Diego, Tijuana, Mexicali, and the sprawling suburbs around those cities were visible, reflecting off the clouds above coastal mountain ranges. Ahead, the sky blazed with stars strewn across an infinite ink-black backdrop. Distant blinking lights showed dozens of other commercial airliners and cargo jets crisscrossing the region at high altitude. The view truly was quite beautiful, he thought dispassionately, and, to the naked eye, enormously peaceful. But those appearances were deceiving. Far off to the northwest, well out to sea, the Americans had one of their Navy E-2C Hawkeye airborne early warning planes, flying a fuel-saving racetrack pattern while they conducted training for naval reserve crews and kept watch over the approaches to this area. The Russians had detected emissions from its APS-145 radar several minutes ago. Fortunately, their converted 737 was still just outside the range where the American AEW aircraft could spot the KH-35 cruise missiles they were about to launch. If one of the Navy's newer E-2D advanced Hawkeyes had been on the station instead, Anyankov knew they would have had to abort this attack. But those planes, with their incredibly powerful solid-state AN-APY-9 radars, were fully committed to service aboard active-duty U.S. naval aircraft carriers. And fortunately, for the purposes of tonight's mission, the carriers were far out to sea, safe from attack. The Russian pilot shrugged. True, getting the chance to sink an American aircraft carrier would have been glorious. On the other hand, if a carrier had been put in port, this whole mission would have been effectively impossible in the first place. It was the old military conundrum. High-value targets generally had the strongest possible defenses. In an all-out war, that might not have mattered, but their job tonight was to strike from concealment and to live to fight another day.
16 green lights, Uspensky said, sounding satisfied. The cross-check with our own navigation fix is complete. All missiles are receiving accurate GLONASS navigation data.
Very good, Anyankov said, equally pleased.
He trusted Filipov's missile assembly work, but he was also well aware that every new piece of technology added yet another potential failure source to any weapon. Computer cards could malfunction for any number of reasons. Power and data cables might be jarred loose by sloppy handling, or even turbulence. And without functioning satellite navigation capability, there was no way any of their missiles could possibly come near tonight's chosen targets, let alone actually score hits.
Downloading pre-programmed attack profiles to the missiles,
his co-pilot continued, selecting new virtual controls on his display. More lights went green.
Attack profiles are locked in.
And Yankov double-checked him on his own display, and then ordered,
Bring all missiles to full readiness.
Uspensky entered more commands into his computer. He checked off reports as they flowed across his display.
All KH-35 radar altimeters are online. Their turbofans are ready. All self-destruct systems are live.
Confirm that every Grand KE radar seeker is disabled, the colonel said.
His co-pilot brought up another schematic.
All radar homers are disabled, he reported.
That was perhaps the most ironic part of this planned attack, Anyankov realized. Since their KH-35s were originally intended for use against enemy ships on the high seas, their advanced onboard radar seekers were optimized for use against moving targets, which meant relying on them tonight would have been a catastrophic mistake. Satisfied that their cruise missiles were ready for launch, Anyankov and Uspensky donned their oxygen masks. He pressurized the 737's cargo deck and transferred flight control to their attack computer. Turbulence increased as the jet's forward door slid open. Launch after launch rolled into position at the door, ejected its four attached missiles, and swung away to make room for the next in line. In less than a minute, all 16 KH-35s were safely away, plummeting silently through the night sky towards San Diego. 10 to 15 meters above the ground, each cruise missile's motor ignited. One after another, the 16 missiles streaked northwest, above clumps of cholla and yucca cactus, desert saltbush, and other scrub brush. Their speed increased steadily, peaking at close to 1,000 kilometers an hour. 13 minutes after launch, the KH-35s screamed low over the low hills southwest of Tijuana. Panicked by the shrill howl of their jet engines, thousands of migratory shorebirds fluttered upward in dense, swirling clouds, One Russian cruise missile raced straight through a maddened flock of gulls, slammed head-on into several of the screeching seabirds, and wobbled out the other side in a cloud of scorched feathers and pulverized bits of flesh. Its turbofan motor fell silent, shedding shattered pieces of fan blades. It veered away just above the surface of the water and then exploded in midair. The rest of the KH-35s flew on, still heading northwest. 30 seconds later, the first missile executed a sharp course change, turning almost due east. One by one, the remaining 14 followed suit. They were paralleling the rugged slopes of the San Miguel Mountains, which straddled the U.S.-Mexico border. Nearing a narrow canyon between two sheer masses of high ground, the KH-35s jinked again, swinging back a little to the west-northwest. Now deep in the jumble of mountains and high-rises of San Diego, the missiles steered an increasingly complicated course. For kilometer after kilometer, they swerved to the east or west around peaks and hilltops, climbing just high enough to clear buildings and hills, between the radar shadows cast by surrounding elevations and their extremely low altitude. They were still effectively undetectable by the U.S. E-2C Hawkeye orbiting off the coast. The GLONASS satellite navigation card inside one of the KH-35s abruptly failed. Although the missile's inertial guidance system tried to take over, integration drift, the accumulation of small errors by its accelerometers and gyroscopes over the past several minutes of flight, led its tiny onboard computer astray. Thinking itself still several hundred meters behind on the flight plan, the missile flew right through a programmed waypoint and crashed into the southern flank of the San Miguel Mountains. Twisted shards of burning wreckage sprayed across a wide area, igniting small fires that quickly guttered out among the mountain's rugged boulder fields and widely scattered tufts of cactus and brush. The surviving 14 cruise missiles came on, streaking west towards San Diego at high speed. Sun King 3-1, E-2C Hawkeye 2000, off the California coast, that same time.
Hey, that's weird.
U.S. Navy Lieutenant Junior Grade Carly DeMello said suddenly. The short, perky brunette, only a couple of years out of Annapolis, was the Hawkeye's radar officer, the most junior of the three equipment operators seated in the crowded compartment behind the turboprop's cockpit. Her boss, Lieutenant Tim Layton, frowned.
"Show me,"
he snapped. As the Combat Information Center officer, he occupied the middle crew position, seated squarely between the E-2C's radar officer and its aircraft control officer.
"I may be picking up bogeys out in the mountains east of San Diego, south of Los Alpine and I-8,
DeMello said. With deft fingers, she used keyboard commands and her trackball to hook or select the new contacts on her big center display.
But they keep disappearing on me.
Following along on his own display, Layton saw a succession of dots blink briefly into existence during a radar sweep and then vanish again. His eyes narrowed in concentration as he invoked his radar masking tool. Immediately, sections of the map layered below their radar imagery showed areas where terrain would block their APS-145 radar. More contacts appeared during the next sweep, and disappeared as soon as they crossed into those terrain-masked places. A text box showed their estimated course, speed, and altitude. Without hesitating, he smashed his transmit button and said excitedly,
"Broadsword, broadsword, Sun King 3-1, quail, quail, quail!
Multiple high-speed targets inbound bearing 082, 13 miles, speed 500, on the deck!
What the hell, Layton?"
the pilot shouted on the intercom.
"This is a training mission. You just radioed an actual hostile missile report to the damned command post. That's because I've got actual missiles in the air, heading right for the Navy piers."
"Oh, shit," DeMello muttered. "This is so not good."
Silently, Layton agreed with her, while everything the Hawkeye's radar saw was being simultaneously fed to the Cooperative Engagement Capability data link to all Navy ships and installations in the region. The speed of those incoming missiles gave the defenders less than 2 minutes to react. That wouldn't have been an insurmountable problem if the fleet were at sea, able to employ every component of its layered defenses from standard medium and long-range anti-air missiles to its phalanx close-in weapon system 20mm automatic cannons and Nauka missile decoys. Unfortunately, though, a substantial number of the Pacific Fleet's warships, including several Ticonderoga-class cruisers and Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, were tied up along the piers, held at anchor by President Barbeau's direct orders. Combat Information Center, CG-53 U.S. Mobile Bay Pier 3, Naval Base San Diego. That same time. Commander Dennis Ninomiya hurried into the dim, blue-tinted CIC. No one commented on the fact that the cruiser's normally unflustered and wholly unflappable executive officer looked out of breath, the klaxons blaring in every compartment as Mobile Bay came to Condition 1. General Quarters signaled this was no ordinary drill.
"Status report," he snapped. "Missiles inbound, XO!"
Brian Thorson, the young lieutenant assigned as tactical action officer for this watch, said, sounding rattled. He pointed to the large screen echoing radar data transmitted by the E-2C Hawkeye offshore. Red icons showed cruise missiles arrowing closer, screaming in just above the rooftops of San Diego's hilly, densely populated suburbs. The leader was just over 1 minute out, with 13 others trailing after it at several second intervals.
"By their flight profile, they're probably KH-35s.
Shit!" Ninomiya cursed.
Whoever had smacked Barksdale Air Force Base a few days ago was now coming after them. He took a closer look at the screen. More icons showed civilian aircraft, including passenger jets on approach to San Diego International, all over the local sky. The airport was less than 5 minutes northwest of their berth. Even if they could bring this ship's anti-radar missiles online in time, there was no way they could fire. In this cluttered air environment, the odds of knocking down a friendly airliner by accident were far too high, which left his cruiser and the other ships tied up in port largely dependent on passive defenses.
"Activate electronic and passive countermeasures only. No kinetics. Repeat. No Sea Sparrows or Sea Whiz."
Sea Whiz, or Phalanx CIWS, was a radar-guided 20mm cannon designed to protect the vessel from incoming missiles out to a range of about a mile, fractions of a second before impact. Close in was a polite way to put it. Last prayer might be a better description.
"Tell Lindbergh Tower and SoCal Approach to clear the Class Bravo airspace now, air defense emergency. As soon as Class Bravo is clear, activate all defenses and countermeasures. Status of the port defenses?
Port defenses activated when we got the warning from AWACS, sir,"
Thorson reported. The port defenses consisted of a variety of electronic jammers that could shut down GPS signals and a missile's active guidance, but those were a last-ditch effort. Nervously, he shrugged his shoulders.
"Missiles still inbound, sir. 5 minutes."
Damn, Mobile Bay's XL thought grimly. Without satellite navigation systems, there was no way those missiles could have flown undetected through the mountain ranges east of the port. So why weren't the high-powered jamming systems the Navy had deployed to spoof GPS and GLONASS receivers working? Had the enemy missiles already shifted to their final radar homing attack mode?
"Where are my..."
At that instant, the tactical action officer shouted,
"Decoys away! Decoys away!"
Once launched, the Australian-designed Nulka rockets, the very word Nulka was an Aboriginal term for be quick, could hover in midair. As they slid downrange from their parent ship, they emitted precisely tailored signals that simulated the signature of a larger vessel, seducing radar-guided missiles off target.
"Quails 4, 6, 7, 9, and 13 departing observed course,"
one of the CIC operators said abruptly. Staring back at the big tactical display, Ninomiya saw 5 of the 14 incoming missiles veer away in several different directions. For a few more seconds, they kept flying, streaking low over San Diego's suburbs at close to the speed of sound. But then, in quick succession, the 5 KH-35s disappeared off the screen, replaced by fast-fading radar blooms of smoke and flame and falling debris.
"Our sat-nav jammers worked,"
Ninomiya said exultantly, and then felt his exultation vanish when he realized what had just happened. Each of the 5 missiles decoyed off course had plowed into neighborhoods packed with single-family homes, apartment complexes, schools, churches, and shopping centers.
"Permission to release CIWS to automatic mode,"
the lieutenant asked. Appalled, Ninomiya snapped,
"Permission denied."
From the ship's position along the pier, Only one of Mobile Bay's two 20mm phalanx close-in weapon systems could bear on the 9 missiles still racing toward the harbor. But if he allowed the computer-controlled 6-barrel Vulcan cannon to fire, it would be shooting right into the heart of San Diego, spewing hundreds of armor-piercing tungsten penetrator rounds per second toward multi-story apartment buildings and houses built on rising ground. The civilian death toll would be horrendous. On the screen, the inbound KH-35s were spreading out. Course tracks showed they were targeted on several of the moored ships, including Mobile Bay. They were close now, only a few seconds away.
Oh, Jesus,
Ninomiya muttered, suddenly praying that officers aboard the other ships in port would decide to risk the collateral damage and open fire.
We're gonna get hit!
One of the ratings shouted. Ninomiya's nerve broke. He swung toward Thorson.
Belay that order! Release battery!
And then it was too late. The first cruise missile slammed into the cruiser's port side, ripping an enormous hole as it punched through the hull plating and a thin layer of Kevlar armor, designed only to protect against fragments and small arms. Its high explosive shaped charge warhead went off deep inside the ship, right outside the Combat Information Center. Neither Commander Dennis Ninomiya nor any of the other officers and sailors inside the CIC had time to react before a wave of fire and razor-edged metal washed across the compartment and killed them all. Hurricane 15 HH-60 Seahawk helicopter over Naval Base San Diego, a short time later. Peering down at the wrecked and burning ships lining the waterfront, U.S. Navy Captain Blair Pollock felt sick. 3 missiles had hit Mobile Bay, gutting her from stem to stern. Only the top of her superstructure and triangular mainmast were still visible, poking out from the oil-stained water. Blackened corpses bobbed alongside the pier. At Pier 4, damage control teams were trying to put out a roaring, fuel-fed fire aboard the San Antonio-class amphibious ship USS New Orleans. More thick black smoke boiled away from the splinter-torn side of USS Dewey, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. In all, 7 of the 9 surviving KH-35s had slammed into ships moored alongside San Diego's piers. Hundreds of officers and men were dead or maimed and burned. Inland, more fires were burning. Huge plumes of smoke soared hundreds of feet in the air, fed by flames consuming homes and businesses in different neighborhoods. Most of the damage came from the 5 missiles that had lost guidance and crashed well short of the waterfront. But in the last seconds, the tactical action officer aboard another of the Ticonderoga-class cruisers, USS Lake Erie, had opened fire with her phalanx guns. They'd knocked down the 2 missiles headed her way, but hundreds of stray 20mm rounds had also shredded homes and businesses across a 4-block swath of the Paradise Village neighborhood, just across the 805 freeway. Early reports flooding in from hospitals and triage centers suggested civilian casualties could easily be higher than those suffered by the Navy. Intellectually, Pollock knew this wasn't as bad as Pearl Harbor. The vast majority of the Pacific Fleet's surface warfare ships were still afloat and undamaged, nor had any serious damage been inflicted on its vital shore installations. But the knowledge was cold comfort in the face of so much death and suffering. 31. In the Altamount Hills, near Livermore, North Carolina. The same time. Kirill Aristov lay prone along the crest of the hill, scanning the barren slopes to the west through his night vision binoculars. He ignored the deep whoomp, whoomp, whoomp coming from the row of 140-meter-tall wind turbines built along the service road just behind him. About 5 kilometers away, fires lit the night sky. Several buildings in the Sandia National Laboratory's Livermore campus were burning, set ablaze by anti-tank missiles and incendiary cannon rounds. Nikolai Dubrunin scuttled up beside him and dropped to one knee.
"Any sign of Borushev and the others yet?"
Aristov shook his head.
"What the hell are they waiting for?" Dubrunin hissed.
2 police helicopters appeared out of the night, clattering toward the burning lab complex. Their green and red navigation lights strobed rhythmically. Dazzling white spotlights probed at the ground, hunting for the attackers, Suddenly there were two blinding flashes from near one of the shattered buildings, trailing bright plumes of exhaust. Two surface-to-air missiles streaked skyward, already guiding on the helicopters. Explosions lit the night as the shoulder-launched SAMs detonated. Enveloped in flames, both helicopters spun down out of control and smacked into the ground. Shards of torn metal and shattered plexiglass pinwheeled away from each crash site.
That, I think, Aristov said coolly.
Now that they'd disposed of the threat of aerial surveillance, he could see six big human-shaped machines sprinting out of the wrecked American Science Complex. The KVMs were moving at more than 60 kilometers per hour, covering ground with every long-legged stride as they climbed into the hills. He lowered the binoculars and looked at Dobrynin.
The Colonel's robots are on the way now. They'll be here in a couple of minutes. Is everything on our end set?
The other man nodded.
Our guys are standing by to load the trucks.
Aristov got to his feet and stuffed his binoculars into a backpack. Their three converted tractor trailers were parked at points along the deserted service road. Once they had Borushiev's war machine safely aboard, it was a short 30-kilometer drive through the Altamont Pass to another safe warehouse. This one was located on the outskirts of the town of Tracy. By the time the Americans could respond in force to this new attack, both the RKU security team and the Colonel's KVM unit would be well hidden. With Dobrynin, he waited at the crest of the hill. When the tall gray war machines drew near, they slowed down. Five stalked silently past the two former Spetsnaz officers, moving on toward the parked trucks. The sixth KVM stopped a few meters away. Its antenna-studded head swiveled toward them.
"Any problems, Captain Aristov?"
A cold, synthesized voice asked.
"No, Colonel," Aristov replied.
Then he noticed the dark smears of blood across the robot's torso and limbs. His voice faltered.
"Good God, what happens down there?"
"Oh, this?" the machine asked, holding out a large metal-fingered hand that appeared to be coated in dried blood and torn human skin.
"After I expended all of my ammunition, some of the American scientists and engineers were still alive. They tried to hide in one of their labs, so I liquidated them at close quarters."
For a moment, the KVM appeared to reflect. Then it said,
"The exercise was very satisfying. In fact, we may be able to conserve our limited ammunition supplies by employing similar tactics on a bigger scale in the future. I will have to consider this option more closely."
Without waiting for a response, the robot turned away and strode off into the darkness. Aristov stared after the KVM in horror. He fought down an urge to vomit.
"Ну вот теперь. Okay, we are fucked,"
he heard Dobrynin whisper.
"Whatever that thing is now, I don't think much of it is really Colonel Borushiev, not any longer. What the hell have these guys done to themselves?"
Iron Wolf Squadron Headquarters, Povich, Poland. A short time later. Patrick McClanahan closed his eyes, accessing the wireless computer links built into his leaf. Most of the exoskeleton's computers and machinery were devoted solely to keeping his crippled body alive, but the system retained a small fraction of the neural interface capability employed by cybernetic infantry devices. It gave him the ability to assimilate and analyze large amounts of data in a fraction of the time it would have taken an unassisted human brain. Ordinarily, he significantly restricted his use of this ability, fearing that it might trigger the same sense of profound, debilitating isolation and mental instability he'd suffered while forced to exist entirely inside one of the robots. But the news from the United States was bad and growing worse with every passing hour. Unless he somehow worked out how the Russians were conducting this secret war of cruise missile strikes and war machine raids, his son's Iron Wolf combat team might as well be based on the dark side of the moon, for all the good that it could do. Without information that would allow him to hit Gryzlov's forces, Kevin Martindale was right, he thought grimly. Right now, Brad and the others were simply hostages to fortune. If they were caught or even spotted by forces loyal to Barbeau, the repercussions would be almost unimaginable. Poland was not his native country, but the years he'd spent in its service had taught him to admire its proud, fiercely independent people. A wry smile creased Patrick's worn, lined face. Okay, perhaps not to the same extent as his son, who was plainly head over heels in love with Nadia Rozek. Still, seeing the Poles crushed between a hostile America duped by Gryzlov's machinations and Moscow's tank and motorized rifle divisions was not something he could accept. So even if rapidly analyzing their painstakingly accumulated fragments of intelligence required him to risk a bit of his regained sanity, it was worth trying, he decided. He was pretty sure that spending more time working through the demonstrated powers and tactics employed by the Russian war robots was a dead end. Cyan analysts had already milked every pixel of video footage and piece of eyewitness testimony for whatever information they contained. But while they now had a much clearer grasp of what the enemy's machines could do in battle, they were still no closer to understanding how those robots avoided detection before they conducted their raids. There were simply too many hypothetical ways to do that, ranging from shipping the war machines as separate components and reassembling them before every attack to using trucks or other large vehicles to move them around, which left the cruise missile attacks conducted by Gryzlov's mercenaries. Patrick strongly suspected that the clues he needed to crack their operational patterns wide open were buried somewhere in all the bits and pieces of evidence gathered in the two different strikes, the first on Barksdale Air Force Base, and now the second on the Pacific Fleet's San Diego piers. Seeing what he could deduce from the fact that they'd used versions of Russia's Kh-35 subsonic cruise missiles in both attacks was his first step. Knowing the maximum range for those weapons, around 160 nautical miles, at least narrowed down the locations of possible launch sites. Reacting to his mental commands, his computer pulled up maps of both the southwestern and southeastern United States, pinpointed Barksdale AFB and Naval Base San Diego, and then drew circles with a radius of 160 miles around each site. Of course, narrowing down was a relative concept, Patrick decided dryly, since each of those highlighted zones contained rather more than 100,000 square miles. He could shave that somewhat for the raid on San Diego, since the Navy's E-2C Hawkeye would have easily detected any launch off the California coast. But even erasing the areas within its effective radar coverage still left a vast region of rough, almost uninhabited deserts and mountains stretching from the Mojave southward deep into Mexico. Bring up all available video and recorded radar footage from each missile strike, he mentally ordered. Downloaded through his neural link, the imagery scrolled through his mind at high speed. Okay, Patrick thought, reviewing what he'd observed. Each attack involved a salvo of between 14 and 16 missiles, and those missiles were fired in rapid succession, each no more than 4 seconds between each launch. So, what did that tell him? For one thing, it almost certainly ruled out the use of any land-based missile system, he realized suddenly. The Russians did have mobile coastal defense batteries equipped with KH-35s, but each Bali battery contained up to 11 specialized vehicles, including self-propelled command and control centers, launchers, and reloading machines. He strongly doubted Gryzlov's mercenaries could hope to move that much equipment along the nation's roads and highways without raising eyebrows somewhere, even if it were possible to believably disguise the launchers and command vehicles as something more innocent. Nor could they hope to fire the KH-35s from the ground undetected. The add-on boosters required to accelerate those missiles to attack speed from the ground generated huge plumes of flame and smoke. Maybe you could get away with a stunt like that out somewhere deep in the Mojave Desert, he thought. But in Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, Oklahoma, or Texas, the 5 states within possible striking range of Barksdale? Rural or not, there were too many people living and working in those places for anyone to have missed seeing a torrent of fire climbing skyward that would have made the biggest county 4th of July fireworks display look like kids shooting off a couple of bottle rockets. He sat up straighter, hearing the servos in the exoskeleton that supported his body whine softly. That left only one realistic option. The Russians were launching their cruise missiles by air. But how, exactly? Quickly he called up more data. Like the U.S., Moscow didn't have many long-range bombers left, no more than a handful each of their sleek Tu-22M3 backfires, turboprop-powered Tu-95 Bears, and supersonic TU-160 blackjacks. Both the backfire and the blackjack maxed out at 8 KH-35 cruise missiles apiece, so a sortie would require 2 aircraft. And while a single TU-95 would have the necessary payload capacity, it was impossible to imagine even one of the big, slow-flying bears successfully penetrating so far into U.S.-monitored airspace without being picked up on civilian and military radars. In fact, none of the Russian bombers were stealthy by any stretch of the imagination. There was just no conceivable flight profile that would let any of them hit either target and escape detection. Which meant Gryzlov's forces were flying in plain sight, Patrick thought coldly. They had to be using a civilian aircraft, one converted to launch cruise missiles. What was more, it had to be a good-sized plane, one with multiple engines and plenty of payload capacity. Jerry-rigging Cessnas or Gulfstream business jets to carry a couple of missiles each wouldn't cut it. And since there was no way the Russians could hope to hang 16 KH-35s off the fuselage and wings of any commercial jet without raising all kinds of unanswerable questions, they must have modified their attack plane to carry its weapons internally. He nodded to himself. No other possibility fit all the known facts. Besides, this wasn't even a new idea. Way back during the Carter administration, there had been a lot of talk about converting Boeing 747 jumbo jets to launch up to 50 Tomahawk cruise missiles as a cheaper alternative to the B-1 Lancer bomber program. He doubted the Russians were using anything as big as a 747 for the clandestine air campaign. If they had, they'd be salvoing a hell of a lot more than 16 of those KH-35s in every attack. No. Based on the numbers of missiles they were launching, Gryzlov's pilots were probably flying a converted twin-engine jet, something like a Boeing 737 or an Airbus 300 or 320. But that still left a hell of a lot of possibilities. Between Boeing and Airbus alone, well over 22,000 of those planes were still flying worldwide, and more than 2,000 commercial cargo flights crisscrossed U.S. airspace on any given day. Was there any way he could winnow out the single kernel of wheat he wanted from all that chaff? For a few moments more, he contemplated the problem, raising possible approaches and as rapidly discarding them. And then, with the sudden zigzag streak of lightning-like inspiration, he saw the answer. Access Federal Aviation Administration flight plan and air traffic control databases, Patrick told his computer through the Leaf's neural link. Access achieved. It reported. If ever a collection of circuit boards and software could sound smug, this one did. Years ago, while he was still president, Kevin Martindale had made sure he could covertly gain entry to most of the federal government's computer networks, using carefully concealed backdoors written into their operating system software. He justified his actions to those in his inner circle by arguing he needed a way to bypass elements of the cumbersome federal bureaucracy during a crisis. Now that Martindale headed Scion, of course, those same hidden back doors allowed his intelligence analysts and field operatives to roam practically at will through the mountains of information routinely collected and squirreled away by a host of different government agencies and departments. The FAA, for example, kept recordings of everything its air traffic controllers saw on radar and said over the radio or telephone for 45 days. With the assurance of long practice, Patrick began sorting through thousands of filed flight plans and air traffic control radio contacts, ruthlessly discarding anything but that pertaining to commercial aircraft transitioning the critical zone centered on Barksdale Air Force Base within 30 minutes of the time the first KH-35 missile exploded. Given the enormous volume of airspace it contained, he still wound up with a list of dozens of different planes that could have been in the right place at the right time to carry out a missile launch. While that was a measurable advance over the prior state of complete ignorance, usually abbreviated as NFC for no fucking clue on internal Scion reports, it was still insufficient. But now, solely because the Russians had carried out a second cruise missile strike, he should be able to winnow that list down even further. Unfortunately, when he ran the same kind of search focused on the possible launch zones for the K-35s that had hammered the Pacific Fleet, he drew a blank. Oh, there were plenty of cargo aircraft flying through U.S. airspace, or bound for Mexico during the half hour or so before the cruise missiles were detected, but none of them matched those on his list from the attack against Barksdale. Patrick frowned, deep in thought. Had he gotten this wrong? Was he missing something obvious? Of course he was, he realized suddenly. He'd committed a classic error of intelligence analysis, relying on assumptions that were too narrowly focused. Expand my time parameter, he ordered. Retrieve all available information for flights through the highlighted regions for up to 6 hours before the attack. Within milliseconds, the computer did as he asked. His list of suspect aircraft expanded almost exponentially.
Take one step forward and end up two steps back, Patrick thought dryly.
So now it was time to take a running jump.
Now, he thought, cross-check the list of planes against those observed flying through the Barksdale missile launch zone.
Only one plane appeared on both lists.
Gotcha,
Patrick growled, looking at the tail number assigned to a 737-200F cargo jet owned by a company called Reagan Air Freight. To make sure, he activated another of Cyan's concealed software backdoors to enter the databases of CENIM, Servicios a la Navegación en el Espacio Aeromexicano, the Mexican government's equivalent of the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. After clearing American airspace, the Reagan airplane had landed at San Felipe. In and of itself, that wasn't too big a black mark. Big planes usually landed in Tijuana, and light planes landed in San Felipe, but either was legal. But then, barely an hour later, it had taken off again, this time heading deeper into the mountains running down the spine of the Baja Peninsula. And there, right around the time those missiles could have been launched toward San Diego, radar data from the Mexican station at Puerto Penasco, Sonora, showed the 737-200 orbiting over the Baja hinterlands, just close enough to the U.S. naval base to carry out a maximum range strike. And it had the payload capacity to carry the number of Russian cruise missiles used in each attack. Bingo, Patrick thought. The crew of that aircraft had the means and the opportunity to hit both Barksdale and San Diego. Their motivation, whether Russian patriotism or mercenary greed, was unimportant. Still using his Leafs interface, he opened a secure channel to Martindale in Warsaw. The older man answered right away.
What is it, General?
Quickly, Patrick filled him in on what he'd discovered.
Reagan Air Freight.
Yes, I see the significance, Martindale said grimly. I'll see what my people can learn about this corporation, and as fast as possible. Patrick heard the strain in his voice.
What happened? He asked.
Grislov's combat robots just destroyed a number of research labs at Sandia's Livermore campus, Martindale said, including one the administration funded to try to replicate Jason Richter's work on cybernetic infantry devices.
Oh, shit, Patrick growled. I can't think of anything more likely to convince Stacy Ann Barbeau that we're gunning for her.
Nor can I, Martindale agreed, which is undoubtedly Grislov's plan. He sighed.
We never had much time to stop him before this spirals out of control, General.
Now we have even less. 32. Iron Wolf Force in the Bighorn National Forest, Wyoming. Several hours later. Brad McClanahan listened closely to his father's explanation of how the Russians were concealing their cruise missile attacks. So they're flying this converted 737 out of a private field in Utah? He asked. Is that the base for their air-launched strikes? The retired general nodded. Because they had a good, secure satellite link, his image was only slightly distorted on their cockpit displays.
The pattern is pretty clear, at least now that we know what we're looking for. My guess, based on the flight paths and filed manifests I've examined, is that they've been ferrying in missiles, or more likely, missile components, from overseas for weeks.
Nadia leaned forward. She appeared wholly focused, like a bird of prey circling on the hunt.
Is it possible that this Moab facility is also the command and control center for Grislov's robot forces?
I doubt it, the older McClanahan replied. He shrugged. Though it might serve as a logistical hub for their robots, since they can fly in equipment, spare parts, and ammunition through the field. But even that isn't certain.
Yeah, Grislov may be crazy, but he's not stupid, Wack Makeomer said roughly. Running both elements of this clandestine operation out of the same location would be way too risky. Nadia scowled. So we destroy the airbase in Utah and still end up no closer to being able to eliminate the primary threat, these Russian fighting machines? Brad looked at her. At least now we know how they're avoiding detection, he pointed out. He turned to the image of Kevin Martindale on the screen. Right, Martindale? The gray-haired man nodded.
Quite so, McClanahan, he shrugged. Your father's discovery that an aircraft owned by Reagan Air Freight had been converted into a cruise missile carrier was the break we needed. There is no way an otherwise legitimate corporation like this cargo company would lend itself to a Russian covert operation, unless Moscow controls it from the inside, Brad finished.
Somewhat nettled by the interruption, Martindale nodded tersely.
Exactly. My operatives have only begun digging, but it seems likely that Russia, or possibly Grislov himself in his private capacity, now owns a controlling interest in both Reagan Air and a ground-based freight hauler FXR Trucking. Their original owner, a Canadian billionaire named Francis Xavier Reagan, sold his personal stake in both companies to an international consortium of banks and investment firms several months ago.
He smiled thinly with humor.
My guess would be this purported consortium is nothing more than a group of straw buyers, a front for Gennady Grislov.
Has anyone contacted this man Reagan to learn more about what he knows? Nadia asked.
The thought had occurred to me, Major Rozhik, Martindale said quietly.
Unfortunately, Reagan vanished somewhere in the North Atlantic, along with his 75-meter-long sailing yacht and its entire crew, a few days after finalizing the sale.
Makeomer snorted.
Gee, isn't that just freaking convenient?
Yeah, there's the Gennady Grislov we all know and hate, Brad agreed, leaving a trail of death and disappearances wherever he goes.
Polish President Piotr Wilk frowned.
The only reason the Russians would want to own a trucking company would be to transport men and supplies, and their war robots, inconspicuously.
Patrick McClanahan nodded.
Using big rigs as a means of covert movement was one of the possibilities my analysts zeroed in on a while back, Mr. President.
And yet you say this gets us no closer to finding Grislov's action teams?
Vilk asked.
Even though we know how to identify the vehicles his men are using?
Martindale shrugged his shoulders.
It's a variation of the needle in a haystack problem, Piotr. There are more than 2 million tractor-trailers operating on U.S. roads and highways. Of those, FXR Trucking owns hundreds in its own right and leases or rents thousands more. And that's not counting the tens of thousands of independent drivers it hires for single deliveries or short-term contracts. Virtually any of those big rigs might be the ones the Russians are using to transport their war robots and support units.
Then why not narrow down the field by using the same method General McClanahan employed to identify their cruise missile aircraft?
Vilk argued.
By correlating the movements of FXR-owned or leased trucks near the areas the Russians have already attacked?
Wilk nodded.
Because no one really tracks trucks or cars in the United States, Patrick explained. Short of a driver getting a speeding ticket or being involved in an accident, there's no real reason for any government, state, local, or federal to pay much attention or keep any records.
Brad frowned.
What about toll roads and bridges, Dad? Most of them are automated now, right?
They use license plate readers or electronic passes to keep tabs on who owes what.
Can't you hack into their databases?
His father smiled.
Not a bad idea. Unfortunately, there isn't that many toll roads or bridges in any of the areas the Russians have hit so far.
But there are a lot of interstate highways, all of them toll-free, Brad realized disgustedly.
All the same goes for state roads and county roads and surface streets, the older McClanahan finished with a wry smile.
He shrugged.
The same problem applies to the idea of cracking into Grislov's movements by checking which trucks supposedly delivered loads to cities or towns near Barksdale AFB, Fort Worth, or the Livermore Labs.
or even to destinations that would take them past those places. No one gives a damn what particular routes a truck driver uses. All they care about is whether the goods get to where they're supposed to go on time.
The predatory gleam in Nadia's eyes sharpened.
If it is truly impossible to track these vehicles, then we should come at this problem from the other direction.
Martindale looked puzzled. And what direction is that, Major?